Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. At this time of year, I like to give a teaching around one of the enlightenment poems of nuns from the time of the Buddha. December is the month in which we traditionally celebrate and remember that the ordination for women was taken from India to Sri Lanka by the Arahant nun Sangamitta Teri at this time. We celebrate that on the full moon of December each year. It's very significant that that ordination possibility was taken outside the boundaries of India to Sri Lanka to make it possible for women in other parts of the world to receive ordination. And of course, here in Perth, we have the Nuns Monastery. And we could say that that's the connection that we have to the nuns' ordination coming from India to Sri Lanka and then eventually some 2,000 years later coming to Perth. And December is also the month when we celebrate the anniversary of the Nuns' Monastery. We've just celebrated our fifth anniversary. So this is a time when it's very nice to look again at the teachings which we received from those nuns who practiced at the time of the Buddha and who were able to realize complete enlightenment. And tonight I'd like to give a teaching around the experience of a nun whose name was Dantika. For those of you who may not be aware, in the time of the Buddha, women from many different backgrounds left home to become nuns, to become homeless ones. And many of the nuns' stories that we're familiar with are the stories of women who suffered great tragedies in their life, whose children died or whose husband died, or there was great calamity, and so because of their sorrow they left home to try to find a way out of their suffering. But there were also many women who left home with no particular tragedy in their life. They heard the Buddha's teaching and they developed great faith and conviction that what he was teaching was the truth. And many of them were from well-to-do families, very prosperous families, and they had many opportunities in life which they gave up in order to become nuns. And many of them came not only from prosperous families, but from very influential and powerful families, from the royal households, or from the households of the very wealthy merchants of the time. And it was because of their conviction, their deep faith in the teaching, that they were willing to go against their social background, their cultural conditioning, to challenge the expectations of the day. In India of that time, and as it is for many women today, women were considered to be a commodity in the household, and they weren't in a position to make choices based just on their own preferences, because being of marriageable age, particularly if the family was well-to-do, it was considered that the woman was an asset because her marriage could forge alliances with other powerful families, could bring wealth and prosperity into the family. And so to make the decision to go against her family's wishes, to go against what was expected of her, was not something that was taken lightly by the women who came from the prosperous and powerful families, because in a sense they were not only doing something that wasn't expected of them, they were disappointing those who were expecting something particular from them. So their faith, their conviction had to be very strong in order to make the decision. And in this particular story, Dantika came from a very powerful family in Sarvati. Her father was one of the ministers of the king. And in the time of the Buddha, Sarvati was one of the, well, was the most powerful city-state. King Pasenadi was the most powerful king of that time. And one can imagine that any of his royal ministers lived in comfort, with great power and great family pride. They were people to be reckoned with. And this young woman would have been brought up with all of the opportunities and expectations that go along with that kind of family position. But it's said that from an early age she heard the Buddha's teaching, and she went very often to the monastery, to Anatta Pindika's monastery in Prince Jeta's Grove. This is one of the famous monasteries that we hear about very often from the time of the Buddha. This was a very well-established monastery. There were many monks and nuns living in that area, many of them enlightened like the Buddha. And the Buddha spent many years living at this monastery, and because he was supported by King Pasenadi and the royal household, there would have been many opportunities for family members to be in the presence of the Buddha or the Arahat monks while they were teaching. And it's said that from an early age, Dantika developed deep faith in the Buddha's teaching. And when she reached the age of discretion, the age when she could start to have something of a say in her future, she let it be known that she wanted to leave the household life and go forth as a nun. And in the information we have, we don't have any clear picture of whether or not her family opposed her decision, but it certainly doesn't say that they approved of it. And what we see as the next step for Dantika is that she didn't stay in Sarvati to continue her practice. Once she was ordained, she left that city altogether and travelled many hundreds of miles away to the city of Rajagaha, which was the other very powerful city-state at the time of the Buddha. And we might wonder, well, why would she do that when she could have, if she stayed in Sarvati, enjoy the support of her wealthy relatives, her wealthy family? She would have been recognised as, oh, she's the daughter of the king's minister, and because of that position would have surely had lots of people wanting to look after her. She would have been known by the people in that area. So perhaps she left that town because she didn't want to be known as so-and-so's daughter. She didn't want to be known because of where she came from. She wanted to be known because of her own practice, her own determination to realise the truth of the Buddha's teaching. And she didn't want to rely just on family support or on her family's good name for the support that she would need as a nun. Perhaps she went away, left all that behind, so that she could practice focusing completely on her own aspiration for enlightenment. And it's said that she took up residence in Rajagaha, which was, as I said, also a very powerful city-state, and also a place where the King Bimbisara, was a supporter, a disciple of the Buddha. And he had given the first land for a monastery to be built to the Buddha, and many, many disciples of the Buddha went and stayed in the vicinity of Rajagaha, because the Buddha himself also liked to practice in that area. And one of his favourite places for going in order to practice in isolation, in seclusion, was called the Vulture's Peak. This was out of the town, some kilometres out of the city, away from the bustle of the city and away from the comfort of the monastery. And the Buddha liked to go out to this secluded place to practice on his own. And in the background story of Dantika, we hear that she followed in the Buddha's footsteps. She also liked to go out into the wild places to practice. And this is something which indicates that this was quite early in the history of the nuns' order, because in the early days, nuns like monks used to live in the forest, meditate in the forest, and only come into the towns in order to go on alms round to receive their food. And they practiced in the same way that the monks practiced. But over the course of time, because a number of nuns were raped and assaulted when they were in the forest on their own, the Buddha made a rule that nuns couldn't live in that way, that they had to live within the boundaries of the town. They had to live in monasteries that were safer. So the fact that Dantika was living in the forest, going into the forest, indicates that this is the early days of the nuns' lineage. And again, we can wonder why she came to Rajagaha and why she came to the Vulture's Peak area. And we might suppose that she was inspired to practice just like the men, to practice as hard, to do it as tough as the Buddha, not staying where there was plentiful support, not staying where it was relatively easy to get what one needed. And also to challenge herself to stay in those wild places. India of those days wasn't like it is today. It had much vast tracts of forest, of areas where wild animals roamed, very close to human settlements. And anyone who was living in the forest would have been very aware that they were sharing that area with wild animals, and not just kangaroos and wallabies, but elephants, tigers, things that could really do you a mischief if they wanted to. And so it was part of the challenge to be willing to be in those wild areas. And so Dantika took up her practice in these areas, spending her time in seclusion in the forest. And having heard the teaching from the Buddha, having heard the teaching from Arahat, monks and nuns, she knew the practice that she had to do. And the practice that she had to do was very similar to what we have to do. That is to train the mind. To train the mind to do as it's told. Watch the breath. Pay attention. Keep on watching the breath. Don't get distracted. When sounds arise, don't run after the sound. When a thought arises about the sound, don't play with that thought. Don't feed that thought. Let it go. Come back to the breath. The same kind of practice that we have to do. And why do we have to do that? So that we can start to maintain focus of attention on one thing, moment after moment after moment, to allow the mind to settle down, to become more peaceful, for more clarity to arise, to see things in detail, to see things beyond their superficial appearance, to see things as they really are. And why do we need to do that? In order to develop deep understanding of how things are, to break through our misconceptions, our wrong understandings about the way things are. The very same practice that we have to do in learning to control the mind, to focus the mind, to deepen the awareness of the mind. This is the practice that Dantika had to do. And having received the instructions, she went into the forest again and again and again to try to make her mind peaceful. And in her enlightenment poem, we read that one day she was coming out of the forest, coming from the vulture's peak, and she saw an elephant coming out of the river where it had been bathing. And if you're familiar with elephants, if you've seen them in their natural environment, seen them bathing, you'll know that elephants love their daily bath. It's the time when they really relax and enjoy themselves. And they'll lie in the bath, they'll lie down so that just their trunk is showing above the water. They'll dip their trunk in, fill it with water, spray themselves. It's a time when they really relax. And the person who's looking after the elephant, whose job it is to train the elephant, is the person who goes and bathes the elephant, because that's their bonding time. That's one of the times when they enjoy something together. And the Mahout, the person who's looking after the elephant, will take something, a coconut husk or a rough piece of rope, and scrub the elephant, give the elephant a good rubbing down. And you'll see the elephant sort of turning this way and that so that it can be scrubbed in all the itchy places, all the places where it can't quite reach itself. And this is how the relationship between the trainer and the elephant is developed. One of the ways, doing something nice for the elephant. And Dantika watched this elephant being bathed and then watched the elephant coming out of the river with the trainer. And as the elephant reached the bank, the trainer said, "Lift your foot." And obediently the elephant lifted its foot, and the trainer jumped on the foot, using it as a step, and jumped up on the elephant's head, behind his head, on his neck. And then the trainer said, "Put the foot down." The elephant put the foot down, and then the trainer commanded the elephant to walk. And on command, the elephant walked. And Dandika was struck by the fact that here was this huge beast which could have, with one misstep, easily squashed the trainer. Here was this beast obediently lifting its foot and allowing the trainer to use that foot as a step, and allowing that trainer to jump up on its neck and putting its foot down on command and walking on command. And it struck Dantika very deeply. Here is this untamed beast which has been tamed. And having lived in the wild places, having lived in the forest and heard the trumpeting elephants, heard the rampaging elephants, seen the damage that they could do, knowing what a wild elephant was like, she was struck by how docile and obedient this elephant, this tamed elephant, had become. And she reflected that this was like the mind. This untamed mind of hers had the same potential as the elephant to become docile and tamed. And as she reflected that here was this trained elephant, big as it was, could now be taken into the marketplace where there was all sorts of noise and bustle. And because it was trained, it could walk through the marketplace safely without damaging anyone else, without damaging itself. And she knew that elephants could be trained even in warfare to go into battle and not to show fear, not to respond to the fear generated by the noise and all of the activity that was going on around them, and not to react when they were hit with spears or with swords, to be trained so that they would continue to be under the control of their mahout, their trainer. And she reflected very deeply that the elephant who's not trained, who's not under control, is a dangerous beast, whether they're in the forest or in the marketplace. But once they're trained, they can be of benefit to everyone. And it doesn't matter where they are, they're no danger to anyone. And it's said that reflecting in this way, she brought up great determination that she was going to do the same kind of work with her untrained, untamed mind. And the phrase that's used in this poem is that she marked inwardly the scene that she had witnessed. It went into her own heart and made such an impact that it opened up a deeper level of faith, a deeper level of determination to realize what could be realized through the path of practice. And in her enlightenment poem, she describes the scene. She describes the effect it had on her, and she says, "I went into the forest and concentrated my mind and became fully enlightened." So there are two aspects of this teaching which I'd like to just draw your attention to, and the first one is the obvious, that all of our minds are like that untrained elephant. And if we reflect on the untrained mind, the untamed passions, greed and hatred, we know that we can do ourselves harm and cause harm to others when we aren't able to control those very strong emotions. And so we start to practice with the determination and the intention to tame those passions which cause harm to ourselves and others. And in order to accomplish that, we have to work directly with the mind. And in this poem, we can again recognize that each one of us is in the same boat. We're all doing the same kind of work. None of us is extraordinary in having to battle with these emotions. And like the elephant, when they're out of control, whether we're in the forest or in the marketplace, whether we're at home or at work, with our friends or people we don't know, when we're out of control, then everyone suffers. But when we're under control, when we're tamed, doesn't matter where we are, doesn't matter who we're with, doesn't matter if we're in difficult circumstances, we can refrain, at least, from hurting ourselves and hurting others. And so, in this poem, we see what is possible, that it is possible for us to train the mind. And the training begins in the meditation with the very simple practice of coming back again and again to the meditation object. And the experience of doing that is that an inner feeling of ease automatically arises. It doesn't have to be brought in from anywhere else. The taming of the mind naturally gives rise to an inner feeling of ease. And we continue to practice again and again and again so that we steadily take control of our wandering, fleeting attention. And as we're able to focus it for longer periods of time on the meditation object, and that feeling of ease arises, it brings with it a stability of mind. When we feel comfortable doing the practice, then it's easier to stay for longer periods watching the meditation object, because we're enjoying it. Enjoyment allows the mind to settle down. And as it settles down, to see what we're watching with greater clarity, to see it in detail, to see it differently from how we've ever seen it before. So when we're watching the breath, to be able to see each breath as an individual segment of the flow of the breath, to feel each breath as an individual experience, the touch of each breath in, the touch of each breath out, the feeling that's there when breath isn't moving. We can notice all of that. We can notice it in detail. And it can change the way we perceive the breath, the way we relate to the breath. Change the way we see it because we recognize the three characteristics of existence, impermanence. The breath is never the same for one moment to the next. Constantly changing, trying to keep the breath being just one way is suffering because it's following its own nature, not our wishes and desires. It doesn't belong to me, it's not under my control. Even though I say my breath, it's just the breath. It points to the truth of non-self. We can only see this when we look closely and in detail again and again and again. And this is how insight develops, deeper understanding of the truth of our existence, how fragile it is that we're depending on this breath, this next breath in, to continue our life. And this next breath is so impermanent, so fleeting, so changeable, so much dependent on the breath out before it, there being air to breathe, the body still functioning, the lungs working, all of those things are required for our next breath in. These deeper truths about our existence we can only see when we're looking deeply at even the most common experience. And this is what the trained mind, the tamed mind, is able to do. The mind that's full of passion, either like or dislike, is a disturbed, busy mind. It can't stay put. It can't stay focused. It can't see clearly. So in addition to training the mind to maintain attention on one object, we have to support that mind not only in meditation but in our daily life, by not feeding the passions in the course of our ordinary existence. And that's why we take the five precepts to help us to restrain our natural tendencies to greed and hatred. And why we cultivate wholesome qualities like kindness, compassion, generosity, reliability, courage, determination. Those qualities help to strengthen the mind and help to balance the negative qualities in the mind. And it's through doing this practice, both on the meditation cushion and in our daily life, again and again and again, that we start to see changes happening. Small changes that persist and become bigger changes, and over time we can notice a turnaround in the way the mind operates. Not in the way that the laws of nature operate, but the way we play out our tendencies towards greed and hatred. And this is the tamed, the trained mind. And this poem of Dantika reminds us that even a wild elephant can be trained and can become useful and can become harmless. So that's the first aspect of this poem, And that's the obvious aspect. But the second aspect of it, which I'd like to just draw your attention to, is the experience that Dantika had when she saw that elephant. It says in the poem that marking inwardly means recognizing the impact that experience has on the mind. Recognizing something which has woken us up. This is one of the ways in which we carry our Dharma practice into our everyday life, into every kind of situation that we encounter in our daily life, by keeping our eyes open for those moments when something really touches us deeply. It can be seeing something that really makes us look up and think. Look up and take notice. It can be hearing something. These powerful experiences are invitations to look more closely, to look more deeply. But very often we're living superficially. We're not paying attention. We may not want to pay attention to that thing which disturbs us. So, for example, at Christmas time, when we're told to be jolly and maybe go and spend some money in order to be happy, that's the sort of time to, as we hear that kind of thing, as we see what's going on around us, to ask the questions, why? What do I really feel? How does that really make me feel? Do I believe that? Is that the truth? What does the Dharma have to say about this? Not just dismiss our reactions. Maybe we think, yes, it's true, I have to go out and be jolly. I have to go out and spend money. Or we might just say, no, I don't do that. So Christmas time can very often be an opportunity to bring up our own personal reactions to what's going on around us. When everyone else is telling us it's this way, we ask ourselves, how is it really? This reflective mind is the mind which is able to ask the really deep questions, the questions which are uncomfortable sometimes when we're going about our daily business, particularly when we keep on reflecting back to the Dharma. Now, recently someone gave me a book which brought up one of these questions for me. This was a book entitled The Girl in the Picture, and it was a book about a very famous picture from the Vietnam War of a 9-year-old girl who'd been hit by napalm, and she was running along the road naked, having pulled off her burning clothes, screaming in pain, wanting help. And this image was one that became very famous in that war, and was one of the images, it said, which turned people's opinions around about whether or not this war should be pursued. And this book is written about this girl to show how she's forgiven the people who dropped the bomb, and how she's made a life for herself through her difficulties. And that was the reason that the book was given to me, to read about this inspiring story of this girl's forgiveness. But when I read the book, something else leapt out at me. And it was the story around how the picture got to be printed in the first place. Because the picture was not one which conformed to the usual standards of journalism at that time, because it showed this young girl completely naked and a full frontal picture of her. And when the picture was taken back to the office where it was to be processed, the staff in the office knew that it didn't conform to the usual standards, and that normally a picture like that, a full frontal nudity, would never be transmitted and never used, even though it was of a young girl. And so they didn't even print the picture. And when the person in charge of the office came in to go through the pictures that had been printed, which was the usual procedure, he went through the negatives and he saw that that picture was one of the negatives. And he identified it immediately as a very important picture. And he went against all the rules of his organisation to print that picture himself and then to transmit it. And the reason he did that, he was a very experienced combat photographer, many years of experience, and had seen many very harrowing scenes in his career. And the reason that he wanted that picture to be printed was because the war had been going on for many years and people had become hardened. People had become blasé. The war was being shown on the television sets in our living rooms. People weren't really paying attention any longer to the suffering that was going on because we'd seen it for so long. And he wanted to wake people up. And he said that he printed the picture because pain keeps us conscious. Now that was the sentence that leapt out at me, which I marked inwardly when I read that book. What did he mean that pain keeps us conscious? Is it true? Does it actually help us to see more clearly what's going on? This is the kind of experience that I'm encouraging all of you to use, just as the seeing the elephant tamed had an impact on Dantika's mind. When you encounter something that leaps out at you and makes you think, don't just put it aside. Take it up, contemplate it, reflect on it, investigate it. What does it mean? In this particular instance, pain keeps us conscious. Yes, when we see that picture, for example, the little girl's pain, her physical pain and her mental pain is so apparent. And when we look at that image, it's not the image of a soldier with a gun. It's not the image of someone who's got any power. It's someone completely powerless. Someone with nowhere to hide. Someone who's completely vulnerable. So the pain is magnified. It's a very powerful image. And yes, we pay attention because of the power of the pain. It's not just another picture in the newspaper that we scan over, that we don't take any notice of. We can't remember where we saw it or what it was about. We know where we saw it. We know what it was about. We know what it was pointing to and how it made us feel when we saw it. And then we ask ourselves, well, does that really follow that pain keeps us conscious? How do I live my life when pain isn't there? Is it true that I skim over the surface of things while things are going well? I never really stop to think about it as long as it's okay. What do I really pay attention to? What do I really start to look closely at? It's pretty true. It's when it's something I don't like, when it's physically painful or mentally painful, that's what grabs my attention most of the time. So, pain. I always thought pain was a terrible thing. I've tried to avoid pain all my life. Maybe pain's a friend. Maybe pain's a help. Maybe pain is what keeps me awake. Keeps me awake to life. When someone close to us that we care about dies, especially if they die suddenly, doesn't that wake us up to the possibility of our own death, like nothing else except our own illness? When we've got a difficult situation in our own life, say we've got an elderly relative who needs nursing care, that very often pushes us to make inquiries about what's available, and then we're aghast to find how limited the resources are, how long the waiting lists are to get into a good nursing home, how few good nursing homes there are. Who would have ever thought that? What can we do about this? This is terrible. And we suddenly take up a particular interest in something because it's touched us personally. Until then, we weren't interested. We wouldn't have known. We didn't care. We're putting it off till later. And it may not be something like that. It may be something even more mundane about there are no good mechanics for cars these days because we had our car in for service and they didn't do it properly. And because we don't like what happened to our car or to our pocketbook because of how much it cost, only then we start to take an interest in garages and mechanics and motor associations and all the things that go with it. So pain keeps us conscious. Pain wakes us up. Now this is just one experience, just one thing that is a cause for contemplating. We look at our own life in the light of what we come in contact with. And what I'm encouraging all of us to do is to keep our eyes open. When something touches us, when it has an impact, it's an invitation. Take up those invitations. Investigate them, and particularly investigate them in the light of Dharma. Is it the truth? What did the Buddha have to say about that? If it's something that's really touching my heart, then it's something that I need to take a look at. I shouldn't ignore. And the more we can do this, the more we can stay awake to what's going on in our life, little by little we'll find that we're more awake even when pain isn't present. We can be awake when things are going well, and we can see their nature. And as we see the nature of the good times as well as the bad times, we're not so surprised when the good times end and the bad times come again. This constant reflection, this constant investigation, this is what brings the Dharma to life, and what opens our mind to deeper and deeper levels of understanding of the truth. So this poem of Dantika, the impact of seeing the elephant, reminds us of the work we need to do to train our own mind, and also that it's possible. And it also encourages us to use whatever opportunities we have to wake up to life so that we can realize the goal of enlightenment. I wish you all a Merry Christmas and a joyful end to the old year and a peaceful beginning to the new year. And may the merit of this teaching help us all to attain Nibbana. If anyone has any questions or comments, I'd be pleased to try to answer some. Well, it's a big question. It's about how you develop equanimity towards the pleasant and the unpleasant experiences in life. And this is basically the practice that we're trying to do. That's the result. Equanimity arises through truly understanding things, seeing them as they really are. And it's the nature of the mind to be drawn to what it likes and to be repelled by what it doesn't like. And it's this constant pushing and pulling which is stressful in our existence. So how to develop equanimity? One of the things you're mentioning is seeing what is happening, that push and pull. So waking up to the push and pull, being able to be mindful that this is pleasure arising and the mind is being pull towards it, that this is displeasure, unhappiness, uncomfortable, and the mind is being repelled. That in itself, to be able to see that, is a very important part of the practice. Because as you see that, you see that each thing is arising and staying for a while is impermanent. It's changing. So the pull towards what is pleasant starts to reduce when you see that this pleasant thing isn't going to last. This unpleasant thing that I'm pushing against so hard, trying to get away from, also isn't going to last. So this reflective quality, together with the mindfulness, this is the mindfulness with clear comprehension of the nature of this experience. However pleasant it is, it's uncertain because it's arisen because of various multiple causes and conditions, and it won't last. It will change as any of those causes and conditions change. And this unpleasant experience is also produced by multiple causes and conditions. It won't last. It will change as any of those conditions change. So this is again how you use the reflective mind. It's not a matter of denying. It's not a matter of pushing away, I shouldn't. But seeing things as they are. So the mindfulness with clear comprehension, and that clear comprehension is supported by Dharma understanding, Dharma knowledge, and investigating, is it true? Is it true that this pleasant thing is impermanent? Is it true that it's dependent on multiple causes and conditions? Is it true that this unpleasant thing is impermanent? This is where we investigate. Don't just believe. And as we do that over and over and over again, then we see for ourselves how foolish to get so caught up in the pleasant and the unpleasant. How foolish to cause myself suffering. And we see we're causing ourselves suffering. So mindfulness and clear comprehension, that's the way. You can't be mindful and you can't have clear comprehension unless the mind is supported in the meditation practice by strengthening it, making it able to see more clearly, look longer at the things it doesn't like to look at, instead of only looking superficially and only paying attention to the pleasant things. The mind is developed in meditation so that it can look more deeply, keep on looking even when it doesn't like what it sees.